From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Karl Rove's defenders are pulling out all stops as they try to justify his exposure of CIA agent Valerie Plame. They're even borrowing arguments from the 1970s used to defend Counterspy magazine.
Investigative journalist Robert Perry on the Karl Rove-Valerie Plame leak case and the Counterspy defense. Is it ever justified to blow a CIA operative's cover? We'll speak with human rights attorney Jennifer Harbury. Her husband was a Mayan leader killed by a CIA asset in Guatemala. We'll also hear from former CIA operative Philip Agee. But first, a Texas judge denies bail to Cuban-born former CIA operative Luis Posada Carriles.
Judge Abbott denied Posada's motion for release on bond and based his ruling on Posada's past acts of terrorism. Although the evidence shows he's the Osama bin Laden of Latin America, the government has so far only charged Posada with having entered the U.S. without inspection.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The battle over Supreme Court nominee John Roberts is heating up. On Tuesday, the White House released 15,000 pages of documents stemming from Roberts' service as an attorney for the Reagan administration. But the White House is refusing to hand over documents related to his work as Deputy Solicitor General under the first President Bush. According to the Washington Post, the newly released documents show Roberts was a significant backstage player in the legal policy debates of the early Reagan administration. Roberts presented a defense of bills in Congress that would have stripped the Supreme Court of jurisdiction over abortion, busing, and school prayer cases. He argued for a narrow interpretation of Title IX, the landmark law that bars sex discrimination in intercollegiate athletic programs. He even counseled his boss on how to tell the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.'s widow that the administration was cutting off federal funding for the Atlanta Center that bears Martin Luther King's name. Other documents show Roberts argued for restrictions on the rights of prisoners to litigate their grievances. He depicted as judicial activism a lower court's order requiring a sign language interpreter for a hearing-impaired public school student who'd already been given a hearing aid and tutors. And he argued for wider latitude for prosecutors and police to question suspects out of the presence of their attorneys. According to the Washington Post, in the rare instances revealed in the documents in which Roberts disagreed with his superiors on the proper legal course to take on major social issues of the day, he advocated a more conservative tack. Meanwhile, the Washington Post reports the Bush administration will not give Senate investigators access to recent federal tax returns of John Roberts. Instead, the IRS will produce a one-page summary of Roberts' tax returns. Historically, nominees to the High Court were required to provide their three most recent annual tax forms, but the Bush administration quietly changed that policy in 2001. The Washington Post reports some senior Republicans and Democrats on the Judiciary Committee are only learning now that the policy had ever been changed. In Britain, police have arrested a man in the city of Birmingham who they believe may have been involved in last week's failed bombings. Police detained him after shooting him with a stun gun. Three other arrests were made today in the city as part of the investigation. The Guardian of London's reporting that hundreds of thousands of Muslims have considered leaving Britain following the July 7th bombings. The British newspaper conducted a poll that found one in five Muslims living in Britain say they or a family member has faced abuse or hostility over the past 3 weeks. Nearly 80% of Muslims in Britain believe the country's participation in the invasion and occupation of Iraq led to the bombings. Overall, about two-thirds of the British population holds that view. In Iraq, it appears legislators are drafting a new constitution that calls for Islam to be the main source of Iraqi law and the official religion of the state. A draft of the constitution was published earlier this week in an Iraqi newspaper. The draft reads, quote, "Islam is the official religion of the state and is the main source of legislation." The draft would make it illegal for the Iraqi government to pass any legislation that contravenes the law of Islam. In addition, the draft constitution would permanently grant the Shiite Grand Ayatollah Sistani and future top Shiite religious authorities official authority to help guide the government. According to Middle East analyst Juan Cole, Shiite judges could use this section to allow the Grand Ayatollah to overrule secular legislation. Cole said the constitution as drafted will move Iraq closer to being a fundamentalist state. Women's groups in Iraq also fear they might lose rights that they've held for decades in Iraq under the secular governments of Saddam Hussein and other Iraqi rulers. The Los Angeles Times reports the draft constitution jettisons nearly 50 years of progressive Iraqi legislation protecting women's rights. In other news from Iraq, a company of the California Army National Guard has been put on restricted duty following allegations that battalion members mistreated detainees in Iraq and extorted shopkeepers. This according to a report in the Los Angeles Times. Among the allegations is that at least six soldiers from the battalion took part in a scheme to extort over $30,000 from Iraqi shopkeepers, apparently in exchange for protection. Up to 17 soldiers are also under investigation for mistreating Iraqi detainees. A videotape reportedly exists that shows soldiers abusing a handcuffed and blindfolded detainee with a stun gun. In addition, a first sergeant has been relieved of duty after being accused of shooting a water heater during an interrogation, then turning to an Iraqi detainee and saying, "You're next." The sergeant then reportedly held his pistol to the man's head, moved it a few inches to the side, and fired. Talks between the U.S. and North Korea have entered a second day. North Korea has reportedly offered to dismantle its nuclear weapons if the United States normalizes relations and pledges not to topple the regime. Meanwhile, South Korea has offered to provide the North with 500,000 tons of rice and some 2,000 megawatts of electricity if it abandons its nuclear ambitions. In news from Capitol Hill, the House is expected to vote as early as today on CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement. A very close vote is expected. This morning, President Bush is holding a closed meeting with House Republicans ahead of the vote. Many Republicans have opposed the trade pact. In New York, Mayor Michael Bloomberg has apologized to a group of British tourists who were targeted over the weekend as possible terror suspects. On Saturday, New York police stormed a sightseeing bus and detained five tourists visiting from the British city of Birmingham. The tourists were all sick. That's S-I-K-H. They were handcuffed, forced to kneel on the street. Police evacuated the entire bus and then searched the belongings of the passengers. The police came to the bus after an employee from the tour bus company, Gray Line, alerted them about the sick tourists acting suspicious. Mayor Michael Bloomberg said, quote, "I certainly apologize on behalf of the city of New York and any time we ever detain anybody unnecessarily." Also in New York, five sick workers who work for the transit system have announced they're planning to sue the MTA because the agency is requiring all sick workers to now place an MTA patch on their turbans. The workers say the request would be equivalent to asking Christian to put the MTA logo on the cross. This news from Puerto Rico. Evidence has emerged that in 2001, the U.S. Navy paid $1.7 million to a public relations firm to increase support for a public referendum over the Navy's use of Vieques. In November 6, 2001, voters in Puerto Rico went to the polls to decide whether the Navy should be allowed to keep use Vieques to live fire training. Voters overwhelmingly called on the Navy to stop using the site, even though the Navy spent approximately $358 per referendum voter in their PR effort. According to documents obtained by Judicial Watch, the Navy hired the Rendon Group to, quote, organize local leaders to build grassroots communication support, ensure the integrity of the voting process, develop methods and tracking procedures to increase support among citizens. The Rendon Group is the same PR firm that was used to help form the Iraqi National Congress, the Iraqi exile group that pushed for the U.S. invasion. Judicial Watch President Tom Fenton said, quote, "I think most Americans would be shocked to learn that the military had a program to ensure the integrity of our voting process." Cycling champion Lance Armstrong, who won a seventh Tour de France, has publicly criticized the war in Iraq because it's prevented the country from spending more on cancer research. He told Time magazine, quote, "Funding for cancer research is tough to come by these days. The biggest downside to a war in Iraq is what you could do with that money. What does a war in Iraq cost a week? A billion, maybe a billion a day." He went on to say, quote, "The budget for the National Cancer Institute is $4 billion. That has to change. It needs to become a priority again. Polls say people are much more afraid of cancer than of a plane flying into their house or a bomb or any other form of terrorism. It's a priority for the American public," Lance Armstrong said. And in Florida, Walmart has ordered a local newspaper, Pensacola News Journal, to remove its racks from stores' property after a columnist at the paper criticized the store's treatment of workers. The column pointed out that thousands of Walmart employees are forced to be on Medicaid because their wages are so low. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, now to our top story, a case we've been following closely for years. That's the case of the Cuban-born former CIA operative Luis Posada Carriles, the man identified by Havana as a leading anti-Castro terrorist. He's currently in immigration detention in Texas, awaits an asylum hearing in late August. He's currently being held on charges of illegally entering the country. But that's just a grain of sand in this case. He stands accused of a wide range of crimes and alleged crimes against Cuba and its president Fidel Castro. Not the least among the charges against Posada, the 1976 bomb of a Cubana airline plane, killing 73 people, including the entire Cuban Olympic fencing team. The Venezuelan government has demanded his extradition. Washington has said it will not hand him over, saying Caracas is in the service of Fidel Castro. There's also the issue of Posada's alleged attempt to kill Castro in 1998 when he was attending a Latin American summit, as well as the 1997 hotel bombings in Havana that killed an Italian tourist. Just some of the long list of charges against Posada. But none of those are part of the current proceedings, at least not officially. On Monday, in El Paso, Texas, immigration court Judge William Abbott rejected a request by Posada's lawyer that he be released on bond, ruling Posada must remain in detention until his case is resolved. In his ruling, Judge Abbott cited allegations that Posada is a terror suspect and said he was concerned Posada would flee. Abbott listed a series of terror allegations against Posada over several decades and said even Posada's participation in operations against Cuba in the early 60s could be considered terror under today's standards. Miami Herald reported the judge's statement seemed to catch by surprise Posada's lawyer, Matthew Archambault, who said he interpreted it to mean the judge would include the Bay of Pigs invasion, which was organized by the U.S. government. In response, Judge Abbott said, quote, "It doesn't necessarily matter who helped it. The question is whether that kind of activity today would be defined as aiding terrorism or participating in acts of terrorism." According to the Miami Herald, Posada played a role in the Bay of Pigs operation but was not part of the invasion force itself. It was after that Posada allegedly joined the CIA, moving to Venezuela in the late 60s. In Caracas, Posada served as a senior Venezuelan security officer, later operated a private security agency. He was arrested and charged in connection with the blowing up of a Cuban jetliner in 1976 that killed 73 people. Acquitted by a military court, Posada escaped from Venezuelan prison in 85 before a civilian court could reach a verdict. Posada was detained in Miami-Dade on May 17th and accused of entering the country illegally. The Venezuelan government has demanded his extradition since then, but has been denied. We go now to Caracas, where we're joined on the line by Jose Pertiera. He's a Washington, D.C.-based immigration lawyer. He's been retained by the Venezuelan government to represent it in the Luis Posada Carriles case here in the United States. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy. It's good to be with you.
It's good to have you with us. Can you respond first to the decision by the El Paso, Texas immigration judge that he should not be released on bail, Posada, and what the significance of saying that he was engaged in acts of terrorism going back to the early 60s?
Well, Amy, the decision by Judge Abbott is no surprise because from the beginning, the way we have evaluated this case is that Posada Carriles is not eligible for release on bond, that he is mandatorily detained because of his past acts of terrorism. And what Judge Abbott has done is simply applied the immigration law to the case. What's significant about the decision, however, is that, curiously, the Department of Homeland Security, rather than charging in its charging document called a notice to appear, rather than charging Posada Carriles as a terrorist, it charged him only as having entered without inspection, a charge that they levy against people who come here to work the agricultural fields of California. And the evidence that is presented in this case, however, by DHS shows that Posada Carriles is engaged in acts of terrorism. So what Judge Abbott has done is he's looked at the evidence, not simply the charging document, and has found that that this man is not eligible for bond. He's also injected into the case Venezuela's extradition request, because one of the concerns that we've had in the past several weeks has been that although Venezuela requested the extradition of Posada Carriles in the middle of June, June 15, that nonetheless the government has yet to even assign a prosecutor to the case or presented the case before a judge in El Paso, a federal judge in El Paso, seemingly wanting the immigration case to proceed so as to lull us to sleep without taking into account the very serious extradition request. Judge Abbott has looked at that and has said, wait, I'm not going to release this man on bond because of past acts of terrorism and because he's wanted in Venezuela for having committed an act of terrorism, namely blowing up, as you indicated earlier, a Cubana Aviación passenger plane that took off from Barbados with the Cuban fencing team and 73 people on board, including a pregnant woman.
Art Heitzer also joins us, chair of the National Lawyers Guild's Cuba subcommittee from Milwaukee. The significance of this decision yesterday in El Paso, Texas.
Well, as Jose said, obviously the denial of bail is critical and was the only reasonable conclusion. But we're looking to the August 29th actual hearing, which will probably take a week, and there'll be coordinated demonstrations not only in El Paso but around the country that you can find more information about at the Answer Coalition website. And, you know, the whole raising of the question by the judge of the Bay of Pigs issue, you know, does raise the question as to his long record of activity, sometimes working for the CIA and sometimes not, and the whole question of state-sponsored terrorism. And if he, you know, he does have leverage against the U.S. government. He was working when he got out of Venezuela and bribed himself out of jail with U.S. money, private sector money, I guess, paying for that. Then he promptly went to work with the Contras in Nicaragua. Negroponte is now our coordinator, our czar of intelligence, and he was the ambassador to Honduras where the Contras were based. So there's probably lots of information that Carriles could reveal that might be very embarrassing to the Bush administration. So their curious position in not really charging him with terrorism but merely entering the country illegally leaves much more to be discovered.
How does this work, that this is now in the purview of an immigration judge? Does this judge only determine whether or not he stays in the United States or leaves? What about this series of crimes? Who considers these? And does this judge decide if he remains in a U.S. jail?
Well, Amy, the immigration case and the extradition case are parallel.
Jose Pechera.
That is to say, the immigration judge in El Paso has no jurisdiction to consider the extradition request. That request is considered only by a federal judge or a magistrate in El Paso, which is where Posada Carriles is detained at this time. The regulations and past case law establish very clearly that it is the extradition case that has priority. Because even assuming for the sake of argument that Posada Carriles were a permanent resident of the United States, that would still make him extraditable. He couldn't raise as a defense that he's a permanent resident. If a federal judge found him to be extraditable, then he would be extradited. What the government is doing, however, is it's focusing all its energy and our time on the immigration case and not pursuing the extradition case at all at this time. And you know, what we want is for this case to go forward on the extradition request. The immigration case is very interesting. There's a lot of issues involved, but as I say, it should not take priority. Now, as to the acts of terrorism committed by Posada Carriles, The one that we're most focusing on is the 1976 blowing up of the Cubana de Aviación plane, because that is the the only case for which an extradition request has been filed. It was filed by the Venezuelan government. Posada Carriles is a Venezuelan citizen. A lot of people forget that. But he is a naturalized Venezuelan citizen who, for a number of years, was head of special operations for the Venezuelan Secret Intelligence Agency in Venezuela in the 1970s. And the blowing up of the Cubana de Aviación flight was planned in Caracas by Posada Carriles, Orlando Bosch, two Venezuelans named Hernan Ricardo and Freddy Lugo. It was planned right across the street from where I'm sitting right now, at a hotel called the Analco Hilton. And the explosives, which were C4 plastic explosives, were armed here in Venezuela. And so Venezuela has jurisdiction over this case. They filed a case, a criminal case against Posada Carriles. While the case was pending, Posada Carriles escaped from jail, ended up in El Salvador, involved in the Iran-Contra scandal, and he has to return to Venezuela to answer these charges and to have a trial here concerning this very, very serious case. It's 73 counts of homicide.
Jose Pertierra on the line with us from Venezuela. He represents the Venezuelan government and their request for extradition of Luis Posada Carriles. Art Heitzer on the line with us from Milwaukee, chair of the National Lawyers Guild Cuba Subcommittee. We'll continue with them, and when we come back, we'll also be joined by Robert Perry, who is a veteran investigative reporter. And speaking of Iran-Contra, one of the reporters who actually broke that story. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting on over 350 Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM stations. We're also podcasting at democracynow.org, video and audio streaming. Our headlines are in Spanish on our website. Audio and transcript and all transcripts of the show are available at our website, democracynow.org. We are talking about Posada, the man who has been accused by the Cuban and Venezuelan government of being a terrorist, sits in an El Paso, Texas jail. An immigration judge ruled yesterday that he cannot be released on bail. We're on the line from Caracas by Jose Pertierra, who represents the Venezuelan government in the request for Posada's extradition. Art Heitzer, chair of the National Lawyer Guild's Cuba subcommittee, as well as Robert Perry, veteran investigative journalist and author of the book Secrecy and Privilege, Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. I'd like to bring Robert Perry into this conversation. You wrote a piece recently that says the New York Times has finally put the case of fugitive terrorist Luis Posada Carriles on page one, observing the violent anti-Castro Cubans' presence in Florida could test George W. Bush's universal condemnation of terrorism, but that principle already has been tested and failed. Explain.
It's been quite clear that there has not been the approach toward Posada Carriles that there has been toward other terrorists. If Posada had been a Baas terrorist or a terrorist from any other part of the world who had not been involved with U.S. intelligence services in the past, he would have been approached in a very aggressive way. There would have been a manhunt when he arrived. Posada even told the Miami Herald at one point in May, I think it was, that he had expected when he snuck into the country earlier, several months earlier, that he would be hunted. And he said it turns out it wasn't being hunted. He finally turned himself in, or he had a press conference, and then was arrested. But the point was that there was really no effort, no serious effort by the Bush administration to apprehend this accused terrorist and bring him to justice. So the question of double standards already is in play. Posada is not being treated like anybody else would be in similar circumstances.
And the ruling of this judge, Bob Perry, talking about his past, going back to the 1960s, which includes the Bay of Pigs, and talking about it in terms of terror, the standards today. How significant do you think this is? And as a journalist, what do you think has been allowable in describing what Posada has done?
Well, there's been a problem in the United States. We have not really gone back over our history very carefully. There have been truth commissions in many countries, Guatemala, South Africa, across the world. There's been efforts to reconstruct the history of the Cold War and many of the crimes that were committed on all sides. That has not happened in the United States. There's been an effort to mythologize the history, to make it seem like it was all quite decent, and there may have been a few excesses here and there, but basically all right. And I think what Posada presents is a question of whether the United States and the American people will ever come to grips with the dark side of that history. And I think what the judge introduced, I think perhaps in passing, was this bigger question. Was the United States itself involved in terrorism when it took actions, especially in Latin America? I covered the Iran-Contra affair. And in the case of Central America, there was violence across the isthmus. Much of it was done by covert operations. People like Posada Carriles played roles in it. There was massive violence against the people of Nicaragua, as well as death squad operations that roamed throughout Guatemala and El Salvador and Honduras. So you have here a history that has never been presented in any kind of full way. And I think the Posada case represents an opportunity, as well as an example of what that history was about.
Do you think it is possible that the U.S. would allow Posada to be extradited as opposed to try him in this country? I mean, for example, if the United States got a hold of Osama bin Laden, would they just send him out of the country?
Well, certainly not. I mean, there are ways you would treat anyone suspected of terrorism from an Islamic perspective. That would be very different, as we've even seen people being arrested for vague suspicions that they might be tied up to terrorism. People after September 11th throughout the country were being rounded up if they had somehow overstayed their visas. There are all kinds of excuses to put people in jail and keep them there for quite a period of time. The approach to Posada has been a glaring contradiction to those principles.
It's interesting to look at the role of Posada and how he is actually tied into the politics of the current administration. I mean, Posada and three other men charged in the conspiracy to attempt to assassinate Fidel Castro at the Ibero-American Summit in Panama. They were sentenced to something like 8 years in prison. The U.S.-backed president there, Maria Moscoso, right in her last days in office, let them go free. Three of them came to this country, to Miami, to a hero's welcome in the anti-Castro community. Just before President Bush, this is right before the Republican convention, went down for a big rally in Miami. Came up to the Republican National Convention. So she released them right before Posada went off somewhere in Latin America. But the close links between what has happened to him over these last few years and the Bush administration maybe...
Well, that goes back...
Go ahead.
So, sorry, I mean, that goes back to the 1980s as well. Remember what Posada was doing in El Salvador. He was working on the Contra War, but he was working closely with Felix Rodriguez. Posada has said he was debriefed by the FBI in 1991 in connection with the Walsh investigation of Iran-Contra, and he provided a great deal of detail, including the fact that Felix Rodriguez was in almost daily contact with George H.W. Bush's office at the White House in the mid-1980s. Bush Sr., of course, has always claimed that he was not involved in these operations. He didn't really know about them. But Posada has potentially the information that he could share that would implicate the current President Bush's father in some of the crimes of that period. Certainly, there were people very close to the first President Bush who were involved, people like Rodriguez, people like Donald Gregg. So you had there the whole issue of how much was covered up in the mid-1980s, and Posada Carriles is a person who has some of those secrets.
You mentioned Felix Rodriguez. Isn't he the man who oversaw the killing of Che Guevara in Bolivia?
That's what he says, yes.
Art Heitzer, you're chair of the National Lawyers Guild's Cuba subcommittee. What activities are planned around Posada right now, who currently sits in this El Paso, Texas jail?
Well, as I mentioned, August 29th, there will be probably a week-long hearing on his asylum application. And so there's going to be a regional demonstration scheduled in El Paso itself on that day, and a call for demonstrations, vigils, sometimes panel discussions around the country. For example, one of the persons killed in the airplane was someone who was going to Cuba to study medical school from Guyana, and his family since emigrated to the United States. His sister is going to be one of the people speaking in El Paso. So we want to focus as much attention as possible on the contradiction that Bob Perry has just mentioned. And I should say that Posada's decision to come to the United States in this context was very interesting because, for example, when the pardon happened in Panama from the assassination attempt on Castro, which would have killed maybe hundreds of Panamanian students, in August of 2000, the other three plotters were immediately whisked by private plane to Miami, got a welcome, as you said, and their background is very interesting. One of them had fired a bazooka to the U.N. building, and he was also convicted and sentenced to 40 years for conspiracy to in the assassination in Washington, D.C. of the former Chilean foreign minister, Orlando Letelier, although he was that was overturned on a technicality on appeals. Another was convicted and imprisoned in Mexico for murdering a Cuban consulate official and was released years later. Another one was sentenced to 10 years for conspiring to kill Cuba's ambassador to the United Nations in 1980. These are the people who Posada was caught with in the Panama assassination attempt in the year 2000, were then all pardoned based on various forms of U.S. intervention, and then were welcomed to the United States with no question. And like Orlando Bush, who worked with Posada in bankrolling and plotting this whole history of terrorism, they're walking free in Miami. So Posada reasonably concluded, well, this is the welcome they get. Why don't I go there, too, and I'll have safe haven? But the tendency of people in the United States and the some media coverage to say with Bush's commitment to the war against terrorism, this doesn't fly with Posada being so high profile, has made it a huge mistake for him and a big hot potato for Bush.
Well, Art Heitzer, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Chair of the National Lawyers Guild Cuba Subcommittee from Milwaukee, Jose Pertierra, representing the Venezuelan government in the case of Posada. He speaks to us from Caracas. And Bob Perry, staying with us, investigative reporter. As we turn now to the Rove Plame case, more than two dozen Democratic senators Monday asked Congress to investigate the White House leak of the undercover CIA operative Valerie Plame. In a letter sent to Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist of Tennessee and House Speaker Dennis Hastert, senators said the outing of Plame most likely compromised her safety. And John Kerry of Massachusetts, who authored the letter, said, quote, "Can anyone argue with a straight face that Congress has time to look at steroid use in baseball but doesn't have the will to provide congressional oversight of the leak of a CIA agent's name?" The letter cited information reported in the press suggesting White House Deputy Chief of Staff Karl Rove and Vice President Dick Cheney's Chief of Staff, Louis Libby, expose Plame's identity. We turn now to investigative journalist Robert Perry. For years, he's worked as an investigative reporter for both the Associated Press and Newsweek magazine. His reporting led to the expose of what is now known as the Iran-Contra scandal, author of Secrecy and Privilege. Your response, your latest article on consortiumnews.com is called Rove's Backers Use Counter-Spy Defense.
Well, Amy, I think the point I'm making is that the people who have tried to defend Karl Rove have gone to such extraordinary lengths over the past several weeks. It's almost as remarkable to see how the conservatives and Republicans have tried to protect Rove as Rove's the allegations of Rove being involved in the leaking in the first place. There's been an effort to release red herrings to confuse the American people about what's really at stake here. And one of the arguments that's been advanced is that, well, Valerie Plame wasn't really that much undercover as a CIA officer. There may have been previous exposures in the intelligence world that would have led people to know that she was an undercover CIA officer, that the CIA wasn't doing enough to protect her secrecy, that she was working out of headquarters, and somehow that the presumption would be that it meant that she was not that secret. All these arguments are rather bizarre because people work at CIA headquarters all the time who are undercover. It's also true that there are times when some information does leak out, but it doesn't mean that anyone's free then to use CIA officers' names. Some of these arguments go back to the original law that was put in place in 1982 to protect the identity of CIA officers. And it was a response to disclosures that were being made by Counterspy magazine in the mid-1970s. Counterspy magazine was trying to disrupt CIA operations that its publishers and people who worked for it felt were immoral. They felt that the CIA was out of control in the 70s. And their way of trying to disrupt those activities was to release the name of some of the agents and thereby make it more difficult for them to carry out their operations. That offended a number of people, including the then CIA director, George H.W. Bush, who made it really a cause to try to get a law put in place that would make it a serious crime to disclose the name of CIA officers. And that obviously is a law that's now at the center of the issue of whether Rove committed a crime and whether people in the White House were engaged in a conspiracy to commit this crime by leaking the name of Valerie Plame. So we get to this interesting point now where some of the arguments that were used in the 70s by supporters of Counterspy to say that, well, there was a case involving a CIA station chief named Richard Welch in Athens who was exposed and then was gunned down in the street. The defense for people who were supporting Counterspy was that Welch's identity had already been released in other publications and that the CIA had been careless in letting him stay in a house that was known to be a CIA safe house. So that was an argument that was used then. It was not considered very acceptable to many people in Congress who went ahead and passed this law. Now it turns out that the people trying to defend Karl Rove are essentially asserting the same thing, that that Valerie Plame was already somewhat outed, therefore it was no big deal that Karl Rove and others in the White House gave her name to Bob Novak and other journalists.
You also write, interestingly, about how the Washington Times has covered this, and also specifically the right-wing commentator Tony Blankley, who used to head up the office of Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich.
Right. Well, basically, the Washington Times is one of the papers that has been most aggressive in making these arguments. They did an article that looked back and said, well, that Plame's identity may have been exposed to the Russians in a previous leak that was from a spy that went over there. They've argued that that the Cubans may have gotten access to this information because a cable had been sent to the Swiss interest section in Havana. They were making these arguments as a way to say, well, you see, this already was known by people and therefore was not really a crime by Rove. The problem becomes that there's no reason to believe necessarily that those leaks, if they indeed happened, would have helped other people, say Al-Qaeda, for instance, get this information about Valerie Plame and the people she was working with on weapons of mass destruction. So the idea that just because there was some possible exposure of an agent doesn't really justify a much wider exposure of that agent. But the Washington Times has certainly pushed this, and Tony Blankley, who is the editorial page editor of the Washington Times, has also argued in a different set of circumstances that Cy Hirsch, who had exposed some reconnaissance operations that were occurring by the United States inside of Iran, that Hirsch may have violated the Espionage Act. And Blankley not only called for an investigation, but pointed out that this could be punishable by death. And so on one side, the Washington Times has tried to make a big case out of exposure of some secrets, which actually might be of very much of importance to the public debate about whether we should go to war in a broader way in the Middle East, while trying to defend Karl Rove's release of information that helped expose a CIA officer who was working on weapons of mass destruction.
Well, Robert Perry, I want to thank you very much for being with us. When we come back from our break, we're going to hear what Philip Agee has to say. We talked to him 2 years ago in Cuba, the former CIA operative on whom many say the Intelligence Identities Protection Act of 1982 was based. Robert Perry, thank you for being there. Investigative reporter speaking to us from Washington, D.C., author of the book Secrecy and Privilege: Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. Stay with us. Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Intelligence Identities Protection Act of 1982 made it a felony to knowingly disclose the identity of a covert government agent. Many believe the law was passed in direct response to former CIA operative Philip Agee blowing the whistle on CIA dirty tricks in his book Inside the Company, CIA Diary. George H.W. Bush, who was vice president when the law was passed, said some of the criticism of the agency undermined secret U.S. clandestine operations in foreign countries. So seriously did the Bushes take the crime of exposing CIA operatives that Barbara Bush, in her memoir, accused Agee of blowing the cover of the CIA station chief in Greece, Richard Welch, who was assassinated outside his Athens residence in 1975. Agee threatened to sue the former first lady, and Mrs. Bush withdrew the statement from additional printings of her book. Still, at a celebration marking the 50th anniversary of the CIA, the elder Bush again singled out Agee in his remarks, calling him a traitor to our country. Well, we spoke with Philip Agee in October of 2003. He was in Cuba. He talked about why George H.W. Bush leveled extreme charges against him and why he denied those charges.
I was involved with quite a lot of other people in a guerrilla journalism campaign to expose the CIA's operations and its people, especially in Western Europe at that time. George Bush's father came in as CIA director the month following the Welch assassination. And as director, he presided over the agency as they mounted a campaign throughout Western Europe, trying to make me appear to be a security threat, a traitor, a Soviet agent, a Cuban agent, all those sorts of things, which led to my expulsion from five different NATO countries in the late 1970s. In fact, it was all based on lies. And to think that I was responsible for the death of any CIA people for their exposures is absolutely false, because no one, as far as I know, of all those people who were exposed as CIA people along with their operations, was ever even harassed or threatened. What happened was their operations were disrupted, and that was the purpose of what we were doing. And we were right to do it then, because the U.S. policy at the time, executed by the CIA, was to support murderous dictatorships around the world, as in Vietnam, as in Greece, as in Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, Brazil, and that's only to name a few. And we oppose that use of the U.S. intelligence service for those dirty operations. And I'm talking about regimes now that tortured and disappeared people by the thousands.
Philip Agee speaking to us from Cuba in October 2003. He then talked about his time in Latin America working for the CIA. He left the agency in 1968 and subsequently decided to expose the CIA support of corrupt oligarchies and death squads. Agee goes on to respond to the outing of Valerie Plame.
Well, first you have to realize that this law, the Intelligence Identities Protection Act, under which someone in the White House may be indicted, is his father's law. This is a law sought by George Bush Sr. when he was CIA director, and later as vice president, he worked hard to get that law passed. And it's the irony of ironies that the law is violated, I believe, for the first time in a serious way by someone working in the office of his own son. This is simply dirty politics, I believe. The ambassador, Ambassador Wilson, poked a hole in this whole pack of lies that had been concocted to justify the war. And in retaliation, they try to ruin his wife's career and get even with him. You could say that it's dirty politics as usual, but also one has to wonder what Papa Bush is thinking about the fact that it's his own son's office that has violated the law that he worked so hard to get passed.
What do you think of people saying it's similar to what you did?
But for different reasons. My reasons were very clear, and we stated them many times. And as I mentioned earlier, I was not alone in that campaign. I was working with a lot of people from a lot of different countries, and it was a spontaneous campaign because people were opposed to the horrible political repression that the United States, through the CIA, was supporting in the 1970s. This current case is totally different. It's simply a dirty, low shot out of revenge, essentially, I believe.
Did you have any dealings with, for example, some of the players we're talking about today, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, George Bush?
I have not had dealings with them, but I followed the political positions of these people since the early 1990s, when Wolfowitz first came out with this policy document on a new United States foreign policy based on what would best be called, I think, neo-imperialism. And then later in the project for a new American century. The major players in this Bush administration were all signers of that policy statement back in the 1990s. And it called for preemptive wars. It called for the control of the United States of the world, essentially. And in this case, it's a question of control of Middle East oil, among several other reasons. And these lies that were used to justify it have all now been exposed. The world knows that they were all false, the justifications, that is. And so the United States has been left alone. Germany is not going to participate. France is not going to participate. Russia is not participating. The United States has been left totally isolated in its intervention in Iraq.
Do you
deservedly so?
Do you condemn the blowing of Valerie Plame's cover?
I don't have any feelings whether it's the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do. What is wrong is that it's simply dirty politics. Whether it was the blowing of her cover or some other action, it's small potatoes, though, compared to the whole scenario of lies that was used to justify the invasion of Iraq and the continued occupation of that country.
Former CIA operative Philip Agee talking from Cuba in October 2003 here on Democracy Now! So to summarize, you have a very unusual picture. You have Republicans not calling for the outing of those involved with the exposing of an undercover CIA operative, and the main focus being one of the top aides of the president, Karl Rove. And you have a situation where, ironically, it was under another Bush administration that the Intelligence Identities Protection Act was first passed. This act imposes strict penalties on the outing of covert operatives. It was under the Bush-Reagan administration, and it's Democrats insisting that the law be enforced. But there is another side to all of this that's been pretty much left out of the discussion. That is human rights activists and torture victims who for years been harshly critical of the CIA's human rights abuses and, among other places, Latin America, who have called for CIA agents and operatives who have committed crimes to be publicly identified in order to bring them to justice, and if the CIA is involved with criminal activity, for that activity to be exposed. Jennifer Horbury is one of those people. Her husband was a Mayan guerrilla leader in Guatemala who was killed by a CIA operative, an asset of the CIA, a Guatemalan military officer. Jennifer Horbury joins us right now in a studio from Boston. Jennifer is a Harvard-trained attorney who has for years spoken out on issues of CIA abuse. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jennifer.
Thank you, Amy.
Can you talk about this side that we rarely see represented right now?
Yes, I think people are overlooking the fact that the CIA for decades across Latin America, continuing now with the abuse and torture of the detainees around the world, have been involved in just outright disappearances, extreme use of torture, and eventual extrajudicial executions even of persons they consider to be undesirable or persons that, from whom they wish to extract information. Certainly my husband was one case. He was a Mayan resistance leader, as you said, who was tortured in Guatemala in a secret cell for more than 2 years. Among other things, he was injected with a toxic gas that caused his body to swell until an arm and leg hemorrhaged. He was placed in a full body cast and then either dismembered or thrown from a helicopter. And it turned out that the high-level intelligence people in Guatemala who were carrying out that torture during those 2 years were, in fact, on CIA payroll as informants. So we have ourselves in the posture of the man who hires a hit person to kill his wife in order to obtain the insurance. These are outright crimes. And I think to the extent that CIA agents anywhere actually aid and abet criminal activity, they should not be shielded at all.
What
it would be much more akin to the FBI agents that work closely with the mafia in Boston. I think that's where the line must be drawn.
What about this view? I mean, you have Sister Diane Ortiz in Washington with torture survivors who are speaking out on this issue. It's one we rarely get in the mainstream media. And how the whole Plame story has played out.
Well, I think we have to remember that there's a sharp divide between whistleblowing activities, where the person is actually trying to expose government wrongdoing, which is, of course, what Mrs. Plame's husband was trying to accomplish. He didn't want to see us go into Iraq on false premises. And in fact, of course, now we have thousands of young men and women from our own country risking their lives and perishing in Iraq on false premises, a war that should not have been started. On the other hand, we have CIA operatives actually engaging in illegal activities, which are prohibited by the laws and treaties of our own country, and they're being shielded. They're even being shielded for ongoing and very violent criminal acts, such as torture and murder. And I think those people cannot be shielded. Whistleblowers must be shielded. Those who are aiding and abetting murder cannot be shielded. I think the divide is very clear.
Jennifer Horbury is author of the book Searching for Everardo, A Story of Love, War, and the CIA in Guatemala, Everardo having been her husband. Her forthcoming book is called Truth, Torture, and the American Way, The History and Consequences of U.S. Involvement in Torture. And what is your response to those who say, if you expose those on the CIA payroll, you're endangering them?
I think that persons who actually commit illegal acts in violation of the scope of authority granted the CIA by the United States Congress, people who blatantly run off with an agency, basically creating a rogue agency beyond the checks and balances established by our Constitution, I think if people are running away with part of our government that they cannot deserve secrecy. I think that anyone carrying out within the legal ambit intelligence gathering services deserve privacy and secrecy. If they're going to risk their lives, we should be protecting them. I think the fact that Ms. Plaim was outed, her career destroyed, and that she may have her life endangered is very shocking when you think that that was in order to silence people who were trying to get the truth to the American public as they as the public was weighing the propriety of going to war against Iraq. I think that's very shocking. That's exactly what the whistleblower protections were created to prevent, exactly that situation. We're supposed to know what our government is doing. There's supposed to be transparency. And when people are secretly violating different laws and statutes or engaging in corruption, we're supposed to reward whistleblowers, not punish them.
Jennifer Harbury, you took a case against the U.S. government to the Supreme Court. You fasted endlessly in both Guatemala and the United States to find out what had happened to your husband. Can you talk about what happened in taking on the U.S. government, how ultimately you found out what happened to Everardo, what happened to your husband, Efraín Bámaca Velásquez?
Well, I first, of course, had been told by the Guatemalan military that he had shot himself in combat to avoid being captured alive. 6 months later, a young prisoner of war for the first time was able to escape from a Guatemalan military base and explain to me that he had not been killed in combat. He was captured alive, that they had fabricated this story about his combat death in order to torture him long-term for his information. And in fact, they had doctors present because of his great intelligence value. They had doctors present to make sure they didn't accidentally kill him. I then opened the grave and found the body of a very different young man, a young soldier who had been killed as a decoy. For the next 2.5 years, I carried out efforts with the OAS. I went to the United Nations. I went everywhere and got no results. No one was able to force the Guatemalan military or the U.S. State Department to carry out any serious actions. And the embassy, the U.S. embassy, told me and also sent form letters repeatedly to concerned members all over Capitol Hill, representatives and senators, that there was no information at all about him. After my third hunger strike, it was, of course, disclosed that the CIA had known from the week of his capture that, A, he had been captured, B, they were faking his death, and C, they were torturing him. And that memo went straight to the State Department. We also found out that when I first started looking for him and was opening the grave with the State Department and embassy sending people to stand next to me, they knew he was still alive, and that so were 350 other prisoners of war in Guatemalan military hands. And in fact, they also knew that he was in the hands of our own paid informants, whom we could have, of course, pulled into line. In other words, at that point in time, we could have saved 350 lives, including my husband's. During all of my efforts, they continued to tell me and to tell the United States Congress and Amnesty, et cetera, that there was no information.
Jennifer, we just have 15 seconds.
So I guess I would just want to close with the fact that our CIA officers are very often throughout Latin America and now in the Middle East very involved in torture and murder. That cannot be covered up. Whereas those who are trying to disclose the truth and keep our government transparent and prevent illegal actions, they should be protected under the Whistleblower Acts.
Jennifer Harbury, I want to thank you for being with us, director of the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee's Stop Torture Permanently campaign, author of the forthcoming book, Truth, Torture, and the American Way, The History and Consequences of U.S. Involvement in Torture. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharifa Bokaduce, John Hamilton, Anna Guerra, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, and Jeremy Scahill, Nell Geiser, and Maddie Harper. Mike DiFilippo is our engineer. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.